This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 20th of September 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's show...
I'm the only candidate in this race who has been part of the hard decisions to take terrorists off the battlefield. And I've laid out a comprehensive plan to meet the evolving nature of this threat and take the fight to ISIS everywhere they threaten us, including online.
The weekend's attacks in New York and New Jersey have made security the main theme once again of this year's US presidential campaign. Clinton accuses Trump of sowing division and playing into the hands of terrorists. Trump says that Clinton has weakened the country as Secretary of State. But who will be able to convince more voters? Then the United Nations suspends all deliveries of aid in Syria after a devastating attack on its lorries, which kills at least 20 people. Also, Jordan votes today in parliamentary elections. They've been hailed by the government as proof of democratic reform. Is that so? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House. Kathleen and Jane, welcome to you both. The United Nations has suspended all deliveries of aid in Syria after an attack on its convoy near Aleppo on Monday. More than a dozen staff members and a local director of the Syrian Red Crescent were killed when the trucks carrying food and blankets were hit. No one has claimed responsibility for the attacks, and it is still unclear whether an airstrike hit the convoy or it was shelled. And Jane Kinnamont, this comes just days after the start of another truce that we were told was definitely a truce this time. It seems like it's anything but.
That's right. The question is really whether the US and Russia still have the political will to try to reinforce this ceasefire. But as with the last ceasefire, part of the problem has been that although the US and Russia want to stop being at odds in Syria, the actors on the ground are not yet ready to stop fighting. And this aid attack comes, you know, after there's already been other breaches of the ceasefire and a lot of trading of blame.
What's interesting, Kathleen, about this, and perhaps it's because it's high profile and it's because all the world's leaders are in New York right now, there's perhaps more attention on it, but you know, the UN's humanitarian chief was adamant that this was, if deliberate, a war crime.
Well, that's going to make a real lot of difference in the negotiations, isn't it? I mean, yes, it is, if, but the effect that's going to have on many of the combatants is probably going to be fairly close to zilch. In a sense, the fact that that's the case reflects the basic lack of real power in the United Nations. And that's all very sad, considering the hope the Founding Fathers had. I mean, I was... Jane, do you have any idea, if I may ask, accusations have been going back and forth? I mean, you're a specialist in this area. Do you actually think that it was the Syrian army or Russians themselves, or that it was yet another mistake by the coalition?
It's pretty hard to tell at this stage. I mean, the supporters of the Syrian government have generally been saying that this was an attack started on the ground by rebels. So they don't seem to be trying to accuse the US or its allies.
Even the Russians actually have said, so the Russian Defence Ministry spokesman, sorry to interrupt, said they did not find any signs of munitions hitting the convoy. And it says everything shown is the result of a fire which mysteriously began at the same time as a large-scale rebel attack on Aleppo.
But the one of the reasons I was asking is because I've picked up that on the Arabic service that someone from the area said they saw Russian reconnaissance planes flying above, watching where the convoy was going. So I didn't know, you know, if you know, taking it in with what your, you know, your deep knowledge is, whether you thought that was indicative.
Well, aid has been massively politicized. The Syrian regime has really used it as a weapon of war. So it's certainly possible that there's been deliberate targeting here. I'm just hesitant to say without having definite knowledge. But what is ironic and what will have made this a particular shock for the UN is that until very recently, the UN has largely been criticized for being too close to the regime because they have said that they've had to work with both the regime itself and members of the Assad family who control a lot of the big charities in government-held Syria just in order to get food into hungry people.
Let's look then at what happens next, Jane, because you know, this was this ceasefire was trumpeted with a big fanfare just a week or so ago by John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov, and you know, there were hopes, nothing more than that, that this could lead to something. Can it be picked up again, do you think?
The conflict in Syria has been complicated because you have what started out as a local fight, you've got regional proxy war, and you've had the US-Russia conflict. The US and Russia have been readier to end their conflict than the other actors, so they may well still want to push for some kind of ceasefire. But the warring parties on the ground still are not exhausted. The rebel groups essentially think that the regime wants to exterminate them. So even though there are many people in Syria who are tired of fighting, they also don't see a way out. If there's any chance to come up with a credible political settlement that allows the fighting parties to see a way out, that might help. But there's so little credibility after so many failed negotiations.
It's also rather difficult for me to see that Assad would be willing to step down, which is the price of the coalition. I just don't think that will happen.
Kathleen, I want to look at the American angle on this, because there is a very deep split between those in the State Department who are backing John Kerry's negotiations here and those in the Pentagon, led by Defense Secretary Ash Carter, who are uneasy, to say the least, about any sort of deal that may have been struck which leads US forces to work alongside Russians in attacking ISIS.
The Pentagon is desperate not to have to do so, because they believe strongly that they will give away to the Russians some of their targeting abilities, some of the methods they use, and indeed that they don't trust the Russians, and they do not see that the game is worth the candle, considering what in future terms they would have to give up. Kerry has been trying ever since he came into office to effect some sort of peace in the Middle East. He believes strongly in diplomacy. He's a good man. He's an intelligent man. He's a strong man. But against real politic that swirls around him, he's just finding it difficult to accomplish anything. And in this case, although I suspect Obama would back Kerry as far as he can, it would be very difficult to go against a Pentagon that says you are going to sell out our future in very important ways.
Jane, on this issue of John Kerry, he talked about when he first took on this job that this was essentially his last big job. Do you think there's the fear amongst not just, you know, those opposed to him, but even maybe some of those of his closest supporters, that he is pushing perhaps too hard to try and get something, so that, you know, he can look back on his 4 years and say, look, I've achieved this? Because when you look at the things he's tried to achieve and they haven't come off, you know, Israel-Palestine being the big one, there's not much in the credit column at the moment. He can't really claim, you know, Iran all for himself, for example.
He was the leader of the Western side in the Iran negotiations, however, and I've talked to several people who took part in those negotiations who do give a lot of credit to the personal rapport he was able to strike up with Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif, among other people involved. But of course, there have been many downsides to the Iran deal as well. And that's one of the factors that allowed Assad to sit in Damascus thinking, my allies are on the up and I don't see any particular reason why I should resign. The Americans will come and they'll go.
And also, just finally on this point, Jane, is there an issue, you know, amongst those who are involved in this Syria conflict that they kind of see Kerry and the Obama administration as a bit of a, well, you guys are on your way out and we don't know what's going to happen next, but both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have suggested they're going to have different views and we might just wait for that?
This is always a problem at this stage in the election cycle. People looking at the regional politics are also thinking there could be a different president coming in Iran next year. And if there is, that will only be a more hardline president.
And Cathy, we were going to talk about the US election in a moment, but just on this issue of the two candidates' stances towards the Middle East, you know, let's leave Trump to one side at the moment. There's a suggestion, really, isn't there, that actually Hillary Clinton as well won't just necessarily follow the Obama doctrine.
No, well, she's always had a more militaristic view towards these types of problems than Obama has. In that case, remember, she was in, when she was in the Senate, she was on the Defense Committee. She knows a lot of the Pentagon people. She has a belief in the use of military force. So I suspect that, in fact, the world suspects that if she's elected, the U.S. will be rearing up a bit more in the way it hasn't during Obama. There won't be any red lines that are then not crossed, for example.
Okay, let's move on now to Jordan, which today votes in parliamentary elections under new revised rules. The elections are held primarily under a form of proportional representation, and officials in the government say the new rules are meant to strengthen political parties, but it could also be seen as a small step towards democratic reform. They are the first free parliamentary elections in 10 years. Jane Kinnamont, is this a step towards democracy, and is it a step that's large enough?
I'm inclined to be cynical. Jordan is one of the few countries that responded to the Arab Spring protests by promising reforms. The king talked a lot about democracy, but there's still heavy restrictions on political activity. We're seeing now free elections after half of the Muslim Brotherhood was banned. The party is split, and there's a kind of pro-government rump that is participating in the elections, partly out of the fear that if they don't participate, they will be outlawed like their former colleagues.
And Cathy, you know, as Jane says, you had a situation post-Arab Spring or at the start of the Arab Spring where Jordan was saying, OK, fine, we're going to have some reforms. One suspects that Jordan's Western allies won't be pushing quite so hard for democratic reforms now as they might have 5 years ago.
Well, see, I'm a bit more optimistic than Jane is, I think, about what's happening in Jordan for various reasons. First of all, it may be pro-government, but there is a section of the Islamic Party, IAF, which, having boycotted the last two elections, are now taking part. The thing about proportional representation is it used to be first past the post, which meant that individuals could be targeted, shall we say. I don't mean badly. I mean, you know, in terms of offers. It's now a list system. And this particular reform coalition has linked up Christians and Muslims and reformers in the same list. But what's really interesting, I think, is the way a youth group has really gotten started. It's done by social media, but it's not done by boycotting or you know, going on demonstrations. They go out to the rural areas, and not so much just in Amman, hold meetings, talk to people, talk about the issues and so forth. And in a way, they're building a network for reform that I think has real promise, you know, in 10 years' time.
I think this sort of civic activism is really important. We'll actually be glad to publish a paper next week by Heba Al-Nasser, a Jordanian analyst, looking at some of this, because I think one of the reasons the government hasn't done more in terms of political reform is that they have felt that the internal pressure for change really subsided because of the perceived failure of the Arab Spring. But what you are seeing is that young people who might not be that interested in things like political parties or these elections or the Muslim Brotherhood are trying to effect longer-term social change in different ways.
And is there a sense, Jane, within Jordan that actually, that everyone wants incremental change? Is there sort of a push towards incremental change rather than big change now?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the Arab Spring came about partly because there was a lot of frustration with reform processes that were really all about promises and cosmetic change and didn't lead to very much. Now what you're seeing is a series of revolutions which, apart from Tunisia, have largely failed to achieve their results. So there's renewed interest in incremental reform. But how sincere people are about it is often very questionable. Often governments like to talk about incremental reform because they mean not reforming, or they mean reforming a tiny bit, or they mean maybe reforming in 10 years' time.
And Cathy, to go back to the thing I asked you about before, I mean, do you think that, you know, Jordan's government is unlikely to come under much pressure from its Western friends to increase that pace of change right now?
Well, they just want Jordan to stay together with, you know, between 3 and 4 million refugees from Syria having fled into the country. I think they will just be happy if the place doesn't fall apart. So no, I think pressure for democratic change will be, shall we say, on the back burner.
Okay. You're listening to Midori House here on Michael 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and my guests, Jane Kinnamont and Kathleen Burke. When we return, we're crossing to the other side of the world to look at the US presidential election.
Table for two, sir. Come right this way. You're cordially invited to the launch of our latest book, The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining. Come the 28th of September, we're laying on a spread of speakers, including River Cafe founder Ruth Rogers and Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé in conversation. Expect tasty treats from talented London chef Tom Oldroyd, drinks aplenty, and a hospitable evening of drinking and dining at Monocle's Marylebone HQ in London. Plus a copy of our freshly prepared book, of course. Hungry for more? We thought you might be. Tickets are available from monocle.com/events.
And you're back with Midori House here on Michael 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and still with me, Kathleen Burke and Jane Kinnamont.
There have been Islamic terrorist attacks in Minnesota and New York City and in New Jersey. These attacks and many others were made possible because of our extremely open immigration system, which fails to properly vet and screen the individuals or families coming into our country.
Donald Trump there lying once again about the cause of an attack in the US. Jane Kinnamont, doesn't really matter that he lies there about this, does it? Because it's potent.
It's absolutely potent. It's an absolutely classic political strategy to blame the foreigner and scapegoat migrants for problems that arise at home.
And Kathleen Burke, I mean, it's tricky then for Hillary Clinton to deal with this sort of rhetoric. What do you make of how she's done with so far?
I was thinking today that she uses too many long words. I mean, instead of talking about his rhetoric, she should talk about his talk or his ridiculous statements. She should. I mean, I think I've decided that's one reason she's not getting across her arguments. Well, there are other reasons, but that certainly seems to me fairly clear. When you listen to Trump, he doesn't use words of more than two syllables normally. It's very difficult because he doesn't the usual norms of truth don't seem to affect him at all. And if you've got someone who's in and someone in contest who does feel that truth is rather a good thing on the whole, one given one thing and another, it's difficult to fight it. This debate is going to be amazing because we'll see if she is able to, in a sense, shout back in ways that can be caught immediately.
Yes, the debate, the first of the three presidential debates, takes place next Monday, Jane, and obviously security, particularly now, is going to be quite high up on the agenda. One concern looking at those debates is who's going to be doing the fact-checking? Because if, for example, Donald Trump says, I was against the war in Iraq, and Hillary Clinton says, no, Donald, you weren't, which is true, he wasn't, he was in favour of it and has been quoted numerous times on the record before saying how he thought it was a good idea. What does the moderator do?
It's a good question. There will be an industry of online fact-checking as well, but there is a huge tendency at the moment for people who support one side or the other to just validate the beliefs that they already had. So whether you will find that any sort of fact-checking changes the mind of the Trump supporters is one of the key questions.
It depends on whether the moderator is a wimp like the last one, who didn't actually challenge Trump on something that was quite clearly a lie. The problem with fact-checking is it always comes afterwards. And it doesn't make the impact that the big lie makes. Fact-checking is great for people who find this interesting, but most people will hear what Trump says and what Clinton says. And if they're pro-Trump, they'll believe him. If they're pro-Clinton, they'll believe her, and vice versa. And it is most depressing.
Kathleen, I want to look at the actual instance that took place over the last few days, in Minnesota, New Jersey, in New York. The fact that certainly when you look at the main incident in New York, the person who is responsible or appears to be responsible has been apprehended, is being held. Do you think that on the whole Americans look at what's happened and think, okay, this guy tried to do something, no one actually died, we caught him, he's been arrested, we followed due process, this shows us in a position of strength? Or do you feel like there's a real feeling of unease across America at the moment?
Well, there's two things. If Hillary Clinton has half a brain, she'll take the position you took, which is they caught them. He caught him within a day, and identified that he was probably an amateur because of the way he'd done it. But of course, there's unease because people look around and think, it could be me next. It's not just the fact that it's Minnesota, for heaven's sakes. Minnesota, nothing ever happens in Minnesota. And the fact that there was a stabbing frenzy there really will make solid citizens in the Midwest a bit apprehensive.
And Jane, while there is no evidence whatsoever of any of these individuals being part of ISIS or Al-Qaeda or any other group, or in Minnesota part of Al-Shabaab, there is the issue that they are being influenced in some way by groups from the Middle East.
True, and those groups in the Middle East are also very globally connected. They're quite highly aware of what's happening in the US. I think it's extremely likely that ISIS leaders in the region will be trying to promote much more serious, large-scale, spectacular attacks in the US in advance of the election, in the hope that they'll get a Trump presidency and that will bring forward the clash of civilizations that they believe is a reality.
But of course, a lot of these lone wolves don't even need encouragement from the Middle East. They hear the news, they hear what people say about Islam, they're disenchanted themselves with life and so forth. I'm not denigrating this. My point is that you don't actually need online encouragement, because the amateur nature of some of these, I suspect, demonstrate that they haven't been led and cultivated, but just lashed out.
It's interesting looking at how these statements and these incidents all feed off each other. After Donald Trump notoriously said that Barack Obama was the founder of ISIS, you then had Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, going on TV in Lebanon saying, see, look, it's true. The Americans, and probably the Israelis as well, were behind this. The leader of the American Republican Party said it. It must be true. He has data. He has documents, was his quote.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. You sometimes see the same conspiracy theories coming up in extreme right US websites that come up in the Iranian media, for example. And as you say, it all feeds off each other and gives this sense of truthiness, as it's been called.
Kathleen, this leads us on to our final story. I want to know, where are the sensible Republicans in all this? Where is Colin Powell coming out saying, I'm a Republican, but I'm voting for Hillary Clinton? Where is George W. Bush saying, I'm a Republican,
George
but I'm voting...
George H.W. or George W.?
George W., gosh, but I'm voting Hillary Clinton. Because it seems we may well know that George H.W. Bush, W.'s father, and a former president himself, may well be voting for Hillary Clinton. There was a story today that Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, niece of John F. Kennedy, met with George H.W. Bush, and then she posted something on Facebook saying, the president tells me he's voting for Hillary. The Bush family is saying nothing, but should they actually say something?
What can they say? It's already been said.
No, but I mean, they could say, yes, it's true. And this is why we're not backing, you know, the supposed leader of our party.
Well, yes, but Bush is in his 80s. He's a very incapacitated man. The idea that he actually has influence is risible, I think. It would be nice, but it I don't think it would make, except that it makes a nice story, of course. There are other important Republicans, I think, who's the fact that they've changed is a bit more interesting, such as Bloomberg, for example, Michael Bloomberg, Meg Whitman. A number of Republicans who said right after the Republican office holders who said right after the convention that they could not vote for Trump. Now, what we would like to know is, are they doing anything about it? I suspect probably not. But again, it's a good story, but its importance. Interest does not necessarily mean important.
But does it not? Okay. Jane, does it not matter that the last two Republican presidents, George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, have not publicly come out to support Donald Trump? And also the last two Republican candidates, John McCain and Mitt Romney, have not come out in support. And in fact, Mitt Romney has... Also, where is Mitt Romney now? He was all very well calling Trump a phony back then when he was in the primary, but you know, he hasn't come out in support of Hillary Clinton yet, has he?
Clearly, a lot of the party grandees are worried that Trump will do significant damage to the party in the long term. So although they cannot want to favour or support Hillary Clinton, they may feel that the party would be better off losing this election and coming back with something different next time. At the same time, Trump hasn't been propelled forward on their support. He's tapped into something else in terms of anti-establishment populism. So even if there was more of a party rebellion, a kind of US version of what we're seeing in the Labour Party here in the UK, it's not clear that would actually give the party what it needs or transform it into a different kind of politics for next time round, because Trump's base is significant. They've been energised by this. Even if he doesn't win, they will be looking for other people to lead them in a not entirely dissimilar style.
Or if it, of course, the other side of it, if it fails terribly, which doesn't sound as though it is, but if it fails at all, these Republicans will not want to have alienated this base. They want to be able to say, you know, let's help pick up the pieces and forward to Republicanism.
Just finally, Jane, when you look towards the first debates on Monday, is there anything that you're particularly keen to see either of the candidates pushed on or quizzed about?
I'm disproportionately interested in foreign policy, which is probably the thing of least interest to...
I don't know, but right now it's a huge issue for them, so...
I think the security thing is going to be absolutely fascinating, and I'm interested to see how the discussion is going to happen when the candidates seem to operate in completely different worlds that play by utterly different rules.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it, Kathleen? It's all very well going, oh, well, look, this is a chance for Trump to be put on the spot. but we're going to have two parallel debates essentially going on, aren't we?
I hope someone asks him, if they put up a 45% tariff against China, what will happen? Because if China put up a 45% tariff, would the Americans like it? I think it would be nice to confront him with the other side of some of these arguments.
Okay, well, we'll see if that happens. For now, Jane Kinnamont and Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The studio manager was Kira Matthew Banerjee. The Atlantic Shift is next, then it's Section D, our design programme. That's at 1900. Midori House, back same time tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.